Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a long, slow march out of the crash of 08. Millions of Americans have barely felt the climb, but at least we've had the word recovery to hang on to. Last week, not so sure. There were lots of bad numbers, especially on jobs, and new fears that the recovery has stalled, that maybe we're even facing a double-dip recession. This hour on Point, fears of a double dip and what we should do about it. You can join the conversation. How's it look from your corner of the economy? Up, down, or sideways? Joining me first today from Washington is Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine. Greg, welcome back. Great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Good to be back.
Sorry to be back with this bad parade of numbers just behind us. Just remind us of what it was that got people so shaken up last week and talking double dip.
Well, we've had a series of disappointing reports on the economy. We've had, for example, signs that the factory sector, which had been doing quite well, has slowed down quite sharply. We had more bad news on housing. We knew it was in a bad situation, but it turns out to be even worse. According to one widely watched index, housing prices have fallen to a new low. And then finally on Friday was the news that the job market slowed dramatically in the month of May, with only about 54,000 jobs created. That's less than one quarter the pace of the prior few months. At this point, these are not the signs of an economy going back into recession. If that were happening, you'd actually see employment going down and some of these numbers turning dramatically negative. Tom, I think what's really disappointing people here is at this point, 2 years into our so-called recovery, we were expecting growth rates on the order of 3 to 3.5%, and it looks like we're stuck at growth at 2 to 2.5%, which is really not fast enough to get the unemployment rate down or to put back to work any of the 8 million people who lost their jobs over the course of the recession.
Well, what happened? I mean, it was just, 3-4 months ago, less, that the Fed was looking at 3.9% growth this year?
Yeah, and I'd like to bet that they're in the process of taking out their sharp pencils and lowering that number yet again. Well, what happened? I mean, that's a great question. I mean, so many things did seem to happen, and when the experts look at this, it's just a shopping list of setbacks. First of all, we had severe snowstorms in the early months of the year. Then we had the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear accident in Japan. That interrupted the supply of some vital parts to assembly plants in the United States. It seems to have taken a bite out of automobile assembly. And then most important of all was the big increase we've seen in gasoline prices from $3 last December to almost $4 nationwide now. And what that essentially means is that a lot of the income that people were getting from increasing employment, not to mention the cut in payroll taxes that was implemented in December, went basically right into the pockets of the gasoline companies.
So what are we looking at here, Greg? I mean, we heard people last week. I heard on the news an analyst on Wall Street saying the markets want a recession, even saying the markets want a depression to wring out too much leverage. What is that perspective?
Well, there are certain people of a very dark persuasion out there who kind of feel that the credit boom that led us into this crisis and recession was so severe and entrenched that you really can't have healthy growth until you've wrung out all those excesses. That's a minority view, but there is something to the point of view that what's going on here, Tom, is that we built up a lot of debt in the decade prior to 2007, basically buying homes that are worth far less than we thought they were. And it's a long and drawn-out process by which banks have to write off the bad debts and families have to essentially get their savings up to a level where they can once again spend again and not have to worry about the decline in the value of their portfolios and their houses. We've seen in situations in the past, such as Japan, such as Scandinavia, that process of paying down debt, what we call deleveraging, is a long and drawn-out process. It can take, on average, 7 years, and we're only 2 or 3 years into this. But I'd like to add, it is a process where there still is growth, not growth of 6%, but at least 3%. So given that, it's still disappointing how we're doing here. And I actually do expect, in coming months, for things to pick up. Gasoline has actually dropped a little bit, has stopped going up. Japan seems to have actually seen its factory production recover from the worst spots.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're right about those being temporary restraints on the economy, we should see a little bit of growth resume. The thing that kind of worries me, Tom, is that if it doesn't happen, neither the fiscal authorities with respect to doing more stimulus seem to have much will to do more, and the Federal Reserve is talking like it's tapped out as well.
Well, what about that? The stock markets took a big drop last week. They're supposed to be, to the extent that they're not just a casino, but they're supposed to be, you know, kind of barometer of the future. Why that drop?
Because clearly they were surprised by the extent of the slowdown on the economic news that was coming in. Now, the positive thing is that the drop in the stock market is still not severe enough that it seems to be forecasting a recession, with the caveat that, of course, that their track record of forecasting things is mixed at best.
Yes, yes.
It still seems to be, you know, corporate profits still seem to be doing reasonably well. But, you know, one of the stories of this recovery is that Wall Street seems to be doing extremely well, but Main Street is not sharing in it.
Moody's rates countries for their credit worthiness and warned last week that they might drop the credit rating of the United States of America. What about that piece, Greg?
Well, that's actually interesting because it was the second time a major credit rating agency gave us that kind of a warning. The first time was Standard & Poor's a few weeks earlier. Interestingly, the thing that Moody's worries most about is the theatrics and the brinksmanship that's going on in Washington, where the Republicans are refusing to consider an increase in the so-called debt ceiling unless the Obama administration and the Democrats agreed to severe, very large spending cuts. And, you know, up until now, we've all had this abiding faith that for all the, you know, game playing and hyperbole, these two sides will eventually sit down and work something out. But we've seen no movement whatsoever towards anything like an agreement in the last few weeks, and we're getting close to the deadline. And Moody's has basically said, look, if you cut this thing too close, you're risking an accident where you don't actually manage to pay your debts on time, something that is virtually without precedent in the history of the United States. All the people, whether it's China or Saudi Arabia or the Americans with their 401ks, who lend you the money in the form of buying your bonds are not going to be very happy about that.
Without an agreement, Greg, could the politicians tip us into a recession?
Yeah, it's quite possible. Now, you'll hear a lot of talk that says that if we get to, say, August 2nd, when the Treasury runs out of maneuvering room in terms of finding ways to pay its bills, that we'll default. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. We may have to stop. It will not be necessary to default on our Treasury bonds. We can still pay the interest on those, but we will have to stop paying for something else, whether it's, you know, paying the salaries of our soldiers, whether it's keeping open federal labs and paying our FBI agents, or cutting checks to Social Security and Medicare recipients. If we were forced into a situation where we had to dramatically cut spending so that it only matched the revenue that was coming in, you're talking about a hit to GDP, if that was sustained, of around 9%. That would be an enormous contraction in economic activity.
No wonder we've got all the furrowed brows out there, so much up in the air. Greg Ipp, thank you very much for being with us.
All right, thanks for having me.
Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine, joined us there from Washington. Joining me now from Durham, North Carolina, is economist Corinne Krupp of Duke University. She was one of 150 economists who signed a letter released this week by House Speaker John Boehner calling for government spending cuts that exceed the debt ceiling hike that may be to come. Corinne Krupp, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Washington is Chad Stone. He's chief economist at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Washington think tank. He was acting executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of Congress in 07 and chief economist for the Democratic staff of the committee from 02 to 2006. Chad Stone, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
So you heard all the worried rumbles last week all over the place on Wall Street. I'm reading here, you know, Dean Baker down your way. He's got a piece in the New Republic. Headline is Disaster Not Averted. The latest jobs numbers and the very real chance, writing here, of another Great Depression. Double dip on your screen, Chad?
Well, not yet a double dip, but certainly this economic recovery has been very sluggish for 2 years now. And the economy and slowing down rather than speeding up in the most recent data. And so I think there's a real concern that the economy is vulnerable to more economic shocks or policy mistakes.
So, Corinne, what about on your screen? The market's really shouting last week and down, and all this chatter about a double dip. Do you see that as a real possibility, just a slowdown or an actual return to recession?
I hope not. I don't think that this is a high probability event unless Congress can't reach an agreement to settle the debt ceiling issue. The numbers have been better lately. We did have some, as Greg mentioned, the weather problems, the Japanese tsunami and earthquake that interrupted the supply chain. There's a lot of things beyond our control that have hit us lately that are temporary. So I don't see it happening. It's not imminent, but it is a little frightening to see these numbers turn down again.
But Chad, there is this narrative out there that we're fiddling, maybe in the same way that the country did in the late 1930s, when it worked to get out of the Depression, then slid back again. Could it be that we're fiddling on the edge of that kind of downhill roll again?
Well, there is definitely that risk because we're so focused on the debt, which is not a short-term problem but a longer-term problem, that we're ignoring the jobs deficit, and there seems to be no will in Washington for additional fiscal stimulus or monetary policy stimulus. And so the private sector is on its own, and there's not enough demand for them to sell all the goods and services they're capable of producing. So yes, we could be headed back because we don't have the policy. We have the policy ammunition, but we're not using it.
When do we know? I mean, how low do you have to get in terms of growth to where the plane just kind of stalls and you definitely lose altitude?
That's a good question, and one that I wish we weren't testing.
Yeah. I don't think we have a specific number on that, but the trajectory hasn't been good. And I think another problem that we've had is we've been doing a lot of things that are actually making it harder to create jobs. If you load up businesses with a lot more regulation and uncertainty, they're not going to be willing to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the fear of a double-dip recession. You saw it rear its head last week quite clearly. We're asking whether we're in it, what we should do about it, with Corinne Krupp of Duke University, an economist there. Chad Stone is with us, chief economist at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. All right, Corinne, let me come first to you. I mean, there's this big, big debate now about what we should be doing here. People like Chad and others are trying to revive maybe the, we need more stimulus line. You're saying we've spent too much, we've got too much regulation, but let's look at spending in particular. John Boehner says, let's cut. We're not going to do anything on this debt ceiling unless we've got cuts. How do we do that without repeating what did happen in the late 1930s, where the Fed, tightened up, moved toward retrenchment, and the economy went back into a deep hole, Corinne? How do we avoid that happening again here?
Well, that's a really important question. That's something that we've got to grapple with. I mean, so macro policy has basically what we think of as two main options. One is the monetary policy side, which is essentially cutting interest rates and making it cheaper to borrow, and that should spur investment and stimulate growth and jobs. And we've pretty much gone as far as we can with that, given that the interest rates are almost zero now.
Yep.
So fiscal policy is the other side, and that's targeted government spending. And usually fiscal policy to be successful needs to be timely, that is, implement it quickly, targeted, that is, go after the sectors that are hurting the most, and temporary. You can't just keep spending and spending. At some point, the private sector is going to have to create the jobs. That's the main source. So when I look at this, I say, yeah, you've got two types of policies, but you also have to look at the role of expectations. And if you create disincentives to create jobs, that can have a real drag on it no matter what you're doing with the other two policies. And I think that's something that we have not done very well.
But if we cut spending and cut it quite sharply now, isn't that almost a guarantee of reduced economic growth?
Yeah, if you do the C plus I plus G plus net exports and you cut G. But I think there's an awful lot in the budget that could be cut. I mean, we've had the GAO report on duplication that came out in March. We have the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction plan that came out in December with lots of very good ideas about things that are duplicative that we can cut. I don't think everything we're spending on now is all critical. And I think we have to look hard. Spending's increased 60% in the last 10 years, and it can't all be absolutely critical. We just can't pay our bills.
Chad Stone, what about it? If we take an axe to government spending, as the Republicans are asking, as we approach this debt ceiling, what looks like a pretty hard deadline here, at some point you run out of rope. What's the impact of that?
You're absolutely right. If we take an axe to spending right now, especially when the economy is still weak, that's contractionary. That is not expansionary. That is another roadblock to the economy getting a strong recovery going. Now, we do have a long-run deficit problem. It's not caused by increases in the kind of spending that people tend to focus on of getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. It's all about rising health care costs in the economy generally and its impact on Medicaid and Medicare. You know, we had that problem in 2007 when the recession started. We have the same problem now with respect to the long-term deficit. But in the short run, our problem is not enough aggregate demand. It's not too much regulation. It's not high taxes. It's not enough aggregate demand. And there is still room for fiscal and monetary policy to do something if policymakers have the will.
But when, Mitt Romney declared for the presidency last week saying President Obama's failed the country, Republicans are saying, look, you tried the stimulus path. It didn't work. That's the line that's being put out. It didn't work. Why do more of it? What do you say to that, Chad?
It didn't work in the sense that the unemployment rate is not 5% right now, but that was not the expectation. It did work in the sense that, I mean, this is not a great bumper sticker, as Congressman Barney Frank said. It could have been worse, but it could have been worse. And the stimulus worked and the TARP worked to keep the economy from really falling off the cliff in 2009. Now, Corinne mentioned timely, targeted, and temporary programs. Well, unfortunately, we missed the boat on timely in 2010 when we should have had some additional stimulus when the economy still could have used a real boost. And it's not too late to do some more now.
Let's hear a little bit from what the administration was putting out over the weekend. Austin Goolsbee, White House economic advisor, was on ABC's This Week yesterday, telling Christiane Amanpour that despite those lousy jobs numbers on Friday, the U.S. economy is in a fundamentally different place than it was in the collapse of 08.
We have moved a long way from when the economy is in a rescue mode, the private sector's in free fall, and the government is the only thing standing between us and falling into another Great Depression. We were losing 780,000 jobs a month when the president comes into office. Fast forward to now, we've added 1 million jobs over the last 6 months.
So don't lose track of the million jobs, says Austin Goolsbee. But here was Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis on CNBC on Friday as those numbers came out, saying, you know, the recovery did feel on an edge.
Our economic recovery is teetering. It goes up and down. But I'm hopeful $2.1 million private sector jobs created is not a bad thing from where we started when we began this administration.
The Labor Secretary there, hopeful, but the recovery teetering. Teetering does not feel like a great place to be. We want it to be stronger than that. Let's begin to bring our listeners in. Savannah, Georgia, James is calling. Hi, James. Thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I spoke with your screener. I'm a business owner in Savannah, Georgia, environmental type work.
Okay.
We do a lot of business-to-business work. Per my invoicing this last month, where all of our monthly receipts go out, met with a lot of these businesses individually. What they're seeing is a lot of bankruptcies where they're not getting paid due to lack of work. And, you know, you hear this double dip recession. Hell, we're still dealing with recession. We are just business owners, but from a long-term standpoint, from our views, we have still been fighting a recession for the last 2 years, much less a double dip. We're still in it initially.
Well, I wouldn't want to say just business owners. As Corinne points out, you know, we need business to be hiring. What's your sense of why it hasn't gotten better, James, and what ought to be done now? Do you want to see government spending cut? Do you want to see more stimulus? What's your sense?
Well, I think the stimulus on paper is a good idea, but I don't see it working itself into the daily structure of businesses. The one thing I have seen in our area is one bridge was built that had the big sign that promoted the money that was used to build this bridge that didn't need to be built in the first place because the other one was fine. I think you've got a lot of this stimulus or so-called stimulus money going to places where it's not needed.
What would help you as a business owner? Corinne says cut regulation. Is regulation the thing that's holding you back or bankruptcies?
Well, with the regulations with us, I can tell you from my business, we are hit with a lot more fees now from an environmental standpoint because we do that type work. I've got an EPA license, state license, all that stuff. Now I'm getting fees in the mail for agencies I've never heard of. you know, we're paying out more money for agency work where we're not getting any representation from them. The only thing I can see is it's just generating a fee. You know, some of them I've just declined not to pay.
I'll deal
with the consequences later.
Making your own way there. James, we wish you luck, and we appreciate your report there from Savannah, from the business owner side. If I may, Corrine, Chad, let me get one more right here from Omaha, Nebraska. Conrad, thank you for calling. Conrad, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, well, I was unemployed for over a year and a half, and I took this job about 6-8 months ago, and it's the lowest paying job I've ever had.
The lowest paying job you've ever had? I'm sorry to hear that.
I can bring $90 a day sitting in here for 10 hours a day sitting in this little booth.
What is it? What are you doing in a booth? Is it parking attendant or what?
Well, I'm doing security for a company right now, but right. I was doing construction for, you know, years and years.
Yeah.
I wasn't living high on the hog before, but we're teetering now. Everything. I've got 2 or 3 shutoff notices every month, and it just feels like we're kicking the can every month, you know?
Shutoff notices.
At some point, that's going to catch up.
Right, on bills that aren't paid. When you look down the road, when you look around, what do you see? Do you see recovery on the way that's coming to you, Conrad, or not?
I don't see any bright spot coming towards me. I don't know what to do at this point.
Oh, boy, sitting in the booth and not knowing what to do, and it would feel a lot better to be out in your old work of construction, no doubt. And we hear that. Conrad, I appreciate your call. Chad, Corrine, let's look at these. Chad, first to you. You've got a business owner who sees bankruptcies from, you know, that his clients, customers are facing, and he's not very optimistic. You got Conrad stuck in a job that doesn't cover the bills. How does big policy relate to these two, in your view, Chad?
Well, we need a new term where we are technically in an economic recovery and out of a recession, but we are in a serious economic slump. Let's call it a slump. We cannot call it an expansion or a recovery because it's too weak for that. But it is anyway. What I heard the business side saying is we need more customers. We need people who aren't facing bankruptcy or our mm-hmm. business customers who aren't facing bankruptcy. What I hear from Conrad is I don't have as much money to spend and therefore I'm not spending as much, and therefore the economy is not getting as much demand for goods and services. What businesses need is customers in their stores spending more money. And what people need is the job and the money to spend.
Well, let me ask you, on that jobless recovery front, Austin Goolsbee, we heard from him earlier, but here he was again on ABC this week saying it's not a jobless recovery. Let's listen to the White House economic advisor.
It is not a jobless recovery. That is an incorrect phrase. After the last recession, in this comparable period, post-recession, we had lost 100,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. We've added more than 2 million jobs. There's a major difference between a jobless recovery and a very deep hole that we're climbing our way out of.
Chad Stone, let me put that to you. The White House economic advisor, you say jobless recovery. He says it is not. What do you say?
I would not say jobless recovery. I'm with him. That's why I say it's a slump. We're in a really deep hole. And we're climbing out of it very slowly. And that's why it feels like a recession to everybody still. So I think he got that one right.
Corrine, what did you hear in our business owner caller and our construction worker who's now, you know, doing security work for not enough pay?
Well, you hear frustration. You hear people who thought by now, 2 years after the recession, you know, we supposedly really hit bottom, that we would be much better than we are right now. And past recessions, we have. So this is very frustrating. This is the slowest recovery we've had since really the Great Depression. I hear frustration with maybe more government interference, more fees, more agencies that he hasn't heard of that he has to deal with. And he's not getting more for it about some of the spending that just goes awry. It sounds like a great idea to spend more money, and that gives people more money to spend and creates that multiplier effect. But if it's spent on things that A, creates very short-term jobs, and B, doesn't really increase productivity, it's creating more of a problem in terms of the debt that we have than it is in terms of increasing, you know, jobs and recovery.
So you come back to cutting the spending, but that, again, it seems to come back to fewer jobs in the short term. I mean, Chad says, yes, we've got to rein it in, but rein it in, you know, a few years out. Now's not the time. What about that argument, Corrine?
Well, I understand that argument, and I know that cutting any spending that means any jobs being cut is scary when the job numbers look bad. I mean, look at the states. They have to balance their budgets. They have to face the reality that revenues are down relative to, you know, the increased demand for social services and spending, but they've got to cut things. So here in North Carolina, we've got a new budget sitting on the governor's desk. The Republicans wanted an 8% cut. She wanted a 4%. They finally came to a 6% compromise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of, I think, where we've got to go. You just can't keep everything spend and expect, you know, to spend our way out of this hole. The government cannot do it by itself.
Ultimately, no doubt. But right in front of us, House Speaker John Boehner, after meeting with President Obama at the White House last week, had some willingness to horse trade on that ceiling, as maybe you did have seen there in North Carolina. But John Boehner's bottom line was cutting the budget, he said, is the way to preserve American jobs.
If we're going to get serious about creating jobs in America, we've got to reduce some of the uncertainty. Some of that uncertainty is caused by the giant debt that was facing our country. The fact that if we're going to raise the debt limit, the spending cut should exceed the increase in the debt limit. Otherwise, it'll serve to cost us jobs in our country. That's not what the American people want.
Chad Stone, you hear there from John Boehner. We've heard from Corinne Krupp today, this word uncertainty. It's been pulled out again and again in the many, many months now since the collapse. What about that factor and how it does or doesn't relate to government spending?
Well, this argument that we need to cut spending in order to strengthen the economy, there was a great cartoon on the Washington Post website of persons in the water and someone is tossing them a barbell saying, you have to build up your strength if you're going to swim that long distance to shore. I mean, that's just the wrong approach to cut spending. The uncertainty manifests itself, one way uncertainty manifests itself is in rising interest rates and a higher risk premium on government bonds. And we have extraordinarily low interest rates right now. The credit markets are telling us they're much more concerned about the sluggish economic recovery than they are immediately about the debt situation.
Corinne, what about those interest rates and their message? They are very, even long-term rates, incredibly low, 3% or something like that. What is the message there?
Well, yes, they are very low right now, and that's because the Fed has flooded the markets with money. There's a lot of liquidity, but banks are not lending as much as they could be. And some of that is because businesses don't want to borrow because they have a lot of uncertainty about the future. You know, you also have the problem with people not wanting to buy houses because housing prices are falling or they can't get out of the ones they're in. Businesses are sitting on piles of cash because they're afraid to invest. I mean, that's where the uncertainty is showing up. It doesn't have to just show up in the interest rates, but on the failure to take risks and invest.
But do we have to? If you throw off regulation, it may give running room. It might. I don't know. But does that mean, you know, we get back into the same kind of financial skullduggery that was going on before, that we have to throw off the environmental regulation that we hoped would keep our air and water cleaner than before? Does it have to be just a free fire zone to get an economy going? Can't we have some kind of responsibility and growth, Corinne?
Exactly. It does not have to be such a stark, it's all or nothing. So, you look back even the last 2 years and these enormous bills that passed. What was the financial regulatory reform bill? It was 2,300 pages long. And it basically said that there's 10 agencies that have to make all these rules up, and we're not sure what they're going to come down with. So it doesn't mean that
But Republicans haven't let them come down to anything, right? I mean, there's been an awful lot of pushback against anything emerging there.
Right. So you continue to fight. You create more uncertainty. You don't regulate what really needs to be regulated. And businesses don't know what's going on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the fear of a double dip recession. Big blast of numbers out last week. Worst of all, the job creation numbers, just not enough. That and a lot of other indicators led people to scratching their heads and saying, what is going on here? Over all this, of course, is that debt ceiling. We're bumping right up against it. The August 2nd, we're told, is about as long as the government can keep that situation at bay. Last month, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke told the Senate Banking Committee that playing with the debt ceiling could have dire consequences for the economy. Here he is.
I think it's a risky risky approach to not to raise the debt limit in a reasonable time. again, the costs, I think at minimum the costs would be an increase in interest rates, which would actually worsen our deficit and would hurt all borrowers in the economy, including mortgage borrowers and the like. The worst outcome would be one in which the financial system was again destabilized, as we saw following Lehman, for example, which of course would have extremely dire consequences for the U.S. economy.
Extremely dire consequences, warns the Fed chief before the Senate there. This is not far away anymore, Corrine. It's coming up. The negotiations have begun with that meeting last week, I guess you'd say. Joe Biden already talking with the congressional group on this front. What about the risk here? If the economy is on some kind of edge here, and last week was a wobble, what kind of threat do you see in these sure-to-be-difficult conversations about the debt ceiling, Corrine? Could that tip it the wrong way? Could it kick-start it into higher gear?
Oh, I think it is very worrisome, and I think this brinkmanship is irresponsible. I know it's political, but it, you know, for years, people worry about things like the trade deficit, which takes a look at, you know, the shortfall between what we save and what we invest, and we have to borrow a lot from abroad because we don't tend to save much as Americans. And, you know, there's been predictions basically since 1980 that if unless we started to get that deficit under control, the foreigners could yank their money from here and create a financial collapse. Well, this is what we're looking at here. We're looking at, you know, obligations that far exceed the revenue that we're taking in. And with this yawning sea of red ink, we do have to start addressing it. And yeah, we have to raise the debt ceiling because in the very short term, we aren't going to be able to close that gap. It's going to take a lot of hard work. But, you know, this is something serious to pay attention to.
Chad Stone, Chad, what are you anticipating as these conversations go forward? They're sure to be fiery. There's going to be dire warnings in every direction here. Where do you think things are likely headed and with what effect on the economy?
Well, I completely agree with Corrine that brinksmanship over the debt ceiling is not doing us any good at all. We've set up a game of chicken with non-negotiable demands and no obvious way out. And even though everyone knows that the debt ceiling needs to be increased because that's about paying bills we've already incurred from legislation we've already passed, the debt ceiling has nothing to do really with long-run deficit reduction. No budget expert ever thinks about the debt ceiling when they think about how to address long-run budget problems. But because it has to be passed, it creates this game of chicken. And that's what's scaring people, is that someone might actually be a car crash because no one bails out in time.
So what happens? I mean, Corrine and 149 other economists signed this petition saying, you know, cut spending here as we deal with this debt ceiling. Former Treasury Secretary George Shultz was on that list. He was there in some pretty rough times back in Ronald Reagan's first term, when unemployment was higher than now at this point in that first term presidency. They're saying cut. If substantial cuts are part of this package, what do you see ensuing, Chad?
Well, the cure being as bad as the disease. If we have substantial short run cuts to deal with the debt ceiling, which legally has to be raised, we really would be better off if we did not have a debt ceiling. But that's for another day. Then you replace one kind of uncertainty. Will they pass it? Will there be financial market uncertainties with a different kind of problem, which is the sharp cuts in spending? We should be having these negotiations about a long-term deficit reduction package outside of the debate over raising the debt limit. There should not be a debate over raising the debt limit. We should raise the debt limit, and we should be working seriously on long-run deficit reduction with a balanced package of taxes and spending.
Corrine Krupp, do you see a kind of, you know, split the baby scenario that would work here, some compromise between positions being staked out that would actually get the country on a more solid footing? Or have we just got two polar views, you know, battling across a chasm?
No, I think that they're getting there. I mean, according to the Wall Street Journal this morning, it said that they've agreed on the first trillion of cuts, and it's the next trillion that's going to be a lot harder and more painful. And the Republicans are going to need to be a little more flexible on the tax issue. I mean, both sides can't get everything they want, and we do have to raise the debt ceiling. There is no question that has to happen.
Let's go to Gary in Charlottesville, Virginia. Gary, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
How are you today?
Pretty well. What do you see, Gary?
Well, you know, your distinguished guests are talking about being stuck, and I'm recalling Economics 202, where there was a thing called Pareto optimality and the PBF function, possibilities frontier function, and you can't help one of the axes, either Y or X, without hurting the other as you move back and forth along this curve.
Okay.
And it seems like that's the position we're in. And I'm wondering if your guests recognize this and the need to shift it out so mm-hmm. then both groups, whatever you want to call them, enjoy increased production. And has the government done that before?
Let us pick it up. Corrine, first to you. Do you recognize the moment we're in those kind of, you know, Econ 101, 202 terms? Or and does that suggest something obvious? Or are we in a new situation? I was talking with listeners over the weekend, and some were saying, we just don't believe we've got the structural sort of undergirding to create good jobs in this country anymore.
Yeah, I know. You hear that. Yeah, the production possibility frontier is really, and moving it out, that's about growth. And growth is longer term. That's not something the government can directly influence in the short term.
Well, Keynesian economics would say otherwise, wouldn't it? Isn't that the whole point?
No, it can boost aggregate demand in the short term, but that is not growth of the economy, really.
But isn't that the idea? Produce, you know, increased demand with the hope of creating growth.
Well, the demand for new goods and services to create, you know, more demand for spending, and spending is consumer spending, especially, is like 70% of current GDP, current output.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what he's talking about is if the government decides to favor certain sectors, where does it get the money to do that? It has to pull money from somewhere else or tax it higher or do something. So it is a, you know, it's a give and take in the short term. You can't just create new things out of nothing. You have to get the money from somewhere else.
Chad Stone, one of the things that Democrats, and you've worked as in the Democratic camp, have proposed is raising taxes on the affluent as part of a budget deal. What about that, getting money from somewhere? How will raising taxes, you know, on the affluent, which isn't one way or another, I guess, taking money out of the economy, help the recovery, or will it?
Well, the whole everything you do for deficit reduction takes money out of the economy. The question is, when do you do it? Do you do it at a time when the economy is strong, or do you do it at a time when the economy is weak? And it's better to wait until the economy is strong. I don't want to bore your listeners too much with economic lectures on the production possibilities frontier. I never thought I would hear that in a radio interview. But
hey, but you're on NPR.
It's true. Educated listeners.
That is right. So Tom, you said the right thing. Keynesians would say we are not operating out at the production possibilities frontier. That's where you have trade-offs. When the economy is at full employment, it's the economy in 2000, you have to make choices among conflicting objectives. When you're inside the production possibilities frontier, you're not taking full advantage of everything that you can produce. And more aggregate demand is what gets you out there, and then you face the harder choices. So taxes on higher income folks would be less damaging now than taxes on lower income folks, or cutting spending that benefits low income folks, because high income people don't spend as much of their additional dollars. So the impact on aggregate demand wouldn't be so bad. But a few years down the road rather than now is when austerity should take effect.
But what about this structural issue? I'm reading here Time Magazine this week. Reina Foroohar is writing there, an economist, who says, she says, the U.S. and the world are in the middle of an economic rebalancing that hasn't been seen since the rise of the great European empires in the 1500s, power shifting from west to east and so on. She's suggesting that we're at a structural change moment here. What about those Americans maybe sitting in a booth somewhere who used to be construction workers, now making $90 a day, can't cover the bills, and wondering, you know, are the rungs on the ladder anymore, Chad?
We always have these conversations in a recession. I'm old enough to go back to the 1975 recession, the 1981 recession. We always have these concerns about where will the jobs come from in the early 1990s. Where will the jobs come from? We didn't anticipate the information technology boom. I'm not saying that there's a guaranteed boom out there, but the situation we're in right now is that sectors across the economy are operating below their capacity. There's plenty of room for expansion without structural issues. Then we get to the longer run issue of where does the growth come from, and how fast do we grow, how strong is our productivity, what does that mean for wages? But right now, jobs are what we need, and we'll worry about the. I mean, we want good wages as quickly as possible too. But there's a long run question of growth and productivity and wages. There's a short run question of getting people back to work.
Let's go to Beth in Schenectady, New York. Beth, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yeah, I'll try to be succinct. It's an artificial market. It's the Democrats are just as much of a problem as the Republicans. They're partially responsible for derivatives. When big business only has money because they go to the parties and say, if you want, we want you to do this for us. We want to have jobs overseas so people over. And I sound horrible saying this. Do not get me wrong. I think we should help people all over the world, but that's not what's happening. You and I buy sweatshop clothing, pay far below market value for it, so some CEO can make a lot of money and in turn pay the relatives of the Democratic and Republican Party machines can hire their brethren.
So what's the answer, Beth? We put up protectionist walls and try and do it all here at home again?
Letting them lobby. We stop letting big business lobby. I would love to see the environment cleaned up. The Democrats never pass any bills with any teeth in them. The Gulf is still a disaster area. So the issue is, again, big business and the fact that, no offense to your guests, but I'm sure they don't make the same money that I make. I just dropped an engine into my car. So for that gentleman to say, well, you know, jobs will come, that's pretty cold. Those of us that eat leftovers day after day after day barely don't or don't pay our bills know that the Democratic machine is making a fortune for themselves, just like the Republican Party, and they're doing it because big business goes directly to them and says, hey, you better do this for me.
And when you've got to put a new engine in the car, that chunk of change can look hard to come by. Corrine, you hear that loss of confidence right there in the way the system works. And an awful lot of people, you know, wondering. I mean, you're saying take the regulation off business, give it some running room here. But we all saw what happened with Wall Street in 08. And I think a lot of Americans share at least some piece of Beth's deep skepticism, which now she's applying here to both parties, about whether the system is not, you know, sort of rigged so that CEOs are going to make money whether the jobs are here or in China, India, you name it. Who's really in the corner of the American worker, Corrine?
Well, I hear her frustration, and I agree with her. I think both sides are doing the same kinds of things. But let's address the issue of playing the game and you know,
the lobbying
making
game.
The system work for you. Mm-hmm. Lobbying, that's right. What is wrong with our tax code that it's so complicated that a PhD economist can't file her own taxes without paying an accountant? I mean, that is a big part of what's wrong with our system.
Well, and that makes room for lobbying and leverage that wouldn't be there with a simpler code?
Sure. The tax code is the way Congress can favor certain industries and try to encourage this behavior and discourage this behavior and pick and choose, which is why it's such a mess. It's a morass, and it needs to be simplified so that it serves the main purpose, which is collecting revenue for the government, not all this social engineering. So that's one part of the problem with all the lobbying. You get rid of all the tax breaks and incentives and, you know, the way they set it up, and that removes at least one source of lobbying.
But if you don't trust the government when there is regulation and social engineering, you call it, how do you trust it when there's none? How do you trust the economy to work right when there's none? Why won't that be more? I don't know.
It doesn't mean none. It doesn't mean none. We still need, you know, of course we know about market failures, environmental regulations. Yep. There's health and safety things. But you can't go too far in the other direction. And creating too much bureaucracy without clear delineation on what is required is also a problem. With the more uncertainty you create, the more expensive it is.
So both of you are saying we're not in this double dip yet. And yet last week, a lot of people were really wringing hands about whether it could be coming. Corrine, first to you. If we head that way, what will the signs be? How will we know? Give us a scenario.
Well, I think the signs will be pretty clear. Unemployment will continue to rise. There'll be more bankruptcies. Housing prices will continue to fall, and people won't be able to get out of their houses. Businesses will fail, and we will just continue to see further declines. We'll see declines in GDP instead of stagnant growth.
Chad,
rising unemployment.
Yeah, Chad, you say maybe another stimulus. Do you see any sign of that coming? And if not, might we see just what Corrine has described?
I do not see more stimulus coming, and that worries me because we've been talking about how there's really not much will for further fiscal stimulus from either party. That Austin Goolsbee was pretty clear about that yesterday. And the Fed is, just as there's this false fear about high interest rates, pretending that interest rates are high right now when they're not, there's also a fear about inflation that a lot of people are manifesting that means that the Fed is reluctant to take any more actions. Yes, short-term interest rates are as low as they can go, but the Fed has other – there could be QE3 if we have another ocean liner to launch, where the Fed uses unconventional methods to make money and credit more available.
Very recently, the Fed did not seem open to that. Do you think last week may have changed their mind?
Well, 1 month of data won't change the Fed's mind, but if we start to see it continuing and we see the kinds of things Corinne was talking about, then yes, they will change their
mind.
What
do you think of the odds, if you had to call it right now, of a real actual double dip that we'll see in the numbers, that we'll see not just this slow situation, but a double dip, Chad? Do you think it's a real risk out there?
I've always been an optimist, and I honestly believe it's less than 50-50, but if we have very contractionary policies, the odds go up.
Well, we're going to see exactly what happens on that front within just a couple of months now. That road is right in front of us. You've helped prep us for what to watch for, and we're grateful for it. Chad Stone with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, chief economist there. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Corinne Krupp, professor of public policy at the Center for International Development at Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. Corinne, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. This is On Point.